Part 6. Chapter 1. Darya Alexandrovna spent the summer with her children at Pokrovskoye, at her sister Kitty Levin's. The house on her own estate was quite in ruins, and Levin and his wife had persuaded her to spend the summer with them. Stepan Arkadyevitch greatly approved of the arrangement. He said he was very sorry his official duties prevented him from spending the summer in the country with his family, which would have been the greatest happiness for him, and remaining in Moscow, he came down to the country from time to time for a day or two. Besides the Oblonskys, with all their children and their governess, the old princess, too, came to stay that summer with the Levins, as she considered it her duty to watch over her inexperienced daughter in her interesting condition. Moreover, Varenka, Kitty's friend abroad, kept her promise to come to Kitty when she was married and stayed with her friend. All of these were friends or relations of Levin's wife, and though he liked them all, he rather regretted his own Levin world and ways, which was smothered by this influx of the Shishchabatsky element, as he called it. Of his own relations, only Sergei Ivanovitch stayed with him, but he, too, was a man of the Koznishev, and not the Levin stamp, so that the Levin spirit was utterly obliterated. In the Levins' house, so long deserted, there were now so many people that almost all the rooms were occupied, and almost every day it happened that the old princess, sitting down at the table, counted them all over and put the 13th grandson or granddaughter at a separate table. And Kitty, with her careful housekeeping, had no little trouble to get all the chickens, turkeys, and geese, of which so many were needed to satisfy the summer appetites of the visitors and the children. The whole family were sitting at dinner. Dolly's children, with their governess and Varenka, were making plans for going to look for mushrooms. Sergei Ivanovitch, who was looked up to by all the party for his intellect and learning, and commanded a respect that almost amounted to awe, surprised everyone by joining in the conversation about mushrooms. "Take me with you. I'm very fond of picking mushrooms," he said, looking at Varenka. "I think it's a very nice occupation." "Oh, we shall be delighted," answered Varenka, colouring a little. Kitty exchanged meaningful glances with Dolly. The proposal of the learned and intellectual Sergei Ivanovitch to go looking for mushrooms with Varenka confirmed certain theories of Kitty's with which her mind had been very busy of late. She made haste to address some remark to her mother, so that her look shouldn't be noticed. After dinner, Sergei Ivanovitch sat with his cup of coffee at the drawing-room window, and while he took part in a conversation he had begun with his brother, he watched the door through which the children would start on the mushroom-picking expedition. Levin was sitting on the window-sill near his brother. Kitty stood beside her husband, evidently awaiting the end of a conversation that had no interest for her, in order to tell him something. "You've changed in many respects since your marriage, and for the better," said Sergei Ivanovitch, smiling to Kitty, and obviously little interested in the conversation. "But you have remained true to your passion for defending the most paradoxical theories." "Katya, it's not good for you to stand," her husband said to her, moving a chair toward her and looking significantly at her. "Oh, there's no time now," added Sergei Ivanovitch, seeing the children running out. At the head of them all, Tanya galloped sideways in her tightly drawn stockings, and waving a basket and Sergei Ivanovitch's hat, she ran straight up to him. Boldly running up to Sergei Ivanovitch, with shining eyes so like her father's fine eyes, she handed him his hat, and made as though she would put it on for him, softening her daring by a shy and friendly smile. "Varenka's waiting," she said, carefully putting his hat on, seeing from Sergei Ivanovitch's smile that she might do so. Varenka was standing at the door, dressed in a yellow print dress, with a white kerchief on her head.
I'm coming, Varvara Andreevna," said Sergei Ivanovitch, finishing his cup of coffee, and putting into their separate pockets his handkerchief and cigar case.
"And how sweet my Varenka is, eh?" said Kitty to her husband, as soon as Sergei Ivanovitch rose.
She spoke so that Sergei Ivanovitch could hear, and it was clear that she meant him to do so.
"And how pretty she is! Such a refined beauty!"
"Varenka!" Kitty shouted. "Will you be in the mill copse?
We'll come out to you.
You certainly forget your condition, Kitty, said the old princess, hurriedly coming out at the door. You mustn't shout like that.
Varenka, hearing Kitty's voice and her mother's reprimand, went with light, rapid steps up to Kitty. The rapidity of her movement, her flushed and eager face, everything betrayed that something out of the ordinary was going on in her. Kitty knew what this was, and had been watching her intently. She called Varenka at that moment, merely in order mentally to give her a blessing for the important event which, as Kitty imagined, was bound to come to pass that day after dinner in the woods.
"Varenka, I would be very happy if a certain something were to happen," she whispered as she kissed her. "And are you coming with us?" Varenka said to Levin in confusion, pretending not to have heard what had been said.
"I'm coming, but only as far as the threshing floor, and there I shall stop."
"Why, what do you want there?" said Kitty.
"I must go and have a look at the new wagons and check their capacity," said Levin. "And where will you be?"
On the terrace.
Chapter 2.
On the terrace were assembled all the ladies of the party. They always liked sitting there after dinner, and that day they had work to do there too. Besides the sewing of baby clothes and knitting of swaddling bands, with which all of them were now busy, jam was being made on the terrace by a method new to Agafea Mikhailovna, without the addition of water. Kitty had introduced this new method, which had been in use in her home. Agafea Mikhailovna, to whom the task of jam-making had always been entrusted, considering that what had been done in the Levin household could not be amiss, had nevertheless put water with the strawberries, maintaining that jam couldn't be made without it. She had been caught in the act, and was now making jam before everyone, and it was to be proved to her conclusively that jam could be very well made without water. Agafea Mikhailovna, her face flushed and angry, her hair untidy, and her thin arms bare to the elbows, was moving the preserving pan over the brazier with a circular motion, looking darkly at the raspberries, and devoutly hoping that they would stick and not cook properly. The princess, conscious that Agafea Mikhailovna's wrath must be chiefly directed against her, as the person responsible for the raspberry jam-making, tried to appear to be absorbed in other things and not interested in the jam, talked of other matters, but cast stealthy glances in the direction of the stove.
"I always buy my maid's dresses myself of some cheap material," the princess said, continuing the previous conversation. "Isn't it time to skim it, my dear?" she added, addressing Agafea Mikhailovna. "There's not the slightest need for you to do it, and it's hot for you," she said, stopping Kitty.
"I'll do it," said Dolly.
And getting up, she carefully passed the spoon over the frothing sugar, and from time to time shook the clinging jam from the spoon by knocking it on a plate that was covered with yellow scum and blood syrup.
"How they'll enjoy this at tea-time,"
she thought of her children, remembering how she herself, as a child, had wondered how it was the grown-ups didn't eat what was best of all, the scum of the jam.
"Stiva says it's much better to give money."
Dolly, meanwhile, took up the weighty subject under discussion, what presents should be made to servants. But
"Money's out of the question,"
the princess and Kitty exclaimed with one voice.
"They appreciate a present." "Well, last year, for instance, I bought our Matryona Semyonovna not a poplin, but something of that sort," said the princess. "I remember she was wearing it on your name-day. A charming pattern, so simple and refined. I would have liked it myself if she hadn't had it. Something like Varenka's, so pretty and inexpensive." "Well, now I think it's done," said Dolly, dropping the syrup from the spoon.
"When it begins to set, it's ready. Cook it a little longer, Agafea Mikhailovna."
"The flies," said Agafea Mikhailovna angrily.
"It'll be just the same," she added.
"Oh, how sweet it is. Don't frighten it," Kitty said suddenly, looking at a sparrow that had settled on the balustrade and was pecking at the centre of a raspberry.
"Yes, but you keep a little further from the stove," said her mother. "A
pot de Varenka," said Kitty, speaking in French as they had been doing all the while, so that Agafea Mikhailovna wouldn't understand them.
"You know, Mama, I somehow expect things to be settled today. You know what I mean. How splendid it would be."
"But what a famous matchmaker she is," said Dolly. "How carefully and cleverly she throws them together."
"No. Tell me, Mama, what do you think?"
"Why, what is one to think? He, Sergei Ivanovitch, could have been a match for anyone in Russia. Now, of course, he's not quite a young man. Still, I know ever so many girls who would be glad to marry him even now. She's a very nice girl, but he might—"
"Oh, no, Mama. Do understand why, for him and for her, too. Nothing better could be imagined." "In the first place, she's charming," said Kitty, crooking one of her fingers.
"He thinks her very attractive, that's certain," Dolly assented.
"Then he occupies such a position in society that he has no need to look for either fortune or position in his wife. All he needs is a good, sweet wife, a quiet one."
"Well, with her he would certainly have it quiet enough," Dolly said.
"Thirdly, that she should love him. And so it is, that is, it would be so splendid.
I look forward to seeing them coming out of the woods and everything settled. I shall see at once by their eyes.
I would be so delighted. What do you think, Dolly?"
"But don't excite yourself. It's not at all the thing for you to be excited," said her mother.
"Oh, I'm not excited, Mama. I think he will propose today."
"Oh, that's so strange, how and when a man proposes. There's a sort of barrier, and all at once it's broken down," said Dolly, smiling pensively, and recalling her past with Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Mama, how did Papa propose?" Kitty asked suddenly.
"It was nothing unusual. It was very simple," answered the princess, but her face beamed all over at the recollection.
"Oh, but how was it?
You loved him anyway, before you were allowed to speak."
Kitty felt a peculiar pleasure in being able now to talk to her mother on equal terms about those questions of such paramount interest in a woman's life.
"Of course I did. He'd come to stay with us in the country. You imagine, I suppose, that you invented something new. It's always just the same. It was settled by the eyes, by smiles."
"How nicely you said that, Mama. It's just by the eyes, by smiles, that it's done," Dolly assented. "But what words did he say?"
"What did Kostya say to you?"
"He wrote it in chalk. It was wonderful." "How long ago it seems," she said.
And the three women all thought about the same thing. Kitty was the first to break the silence. She remembered all of that last winter before her marriage and her passion for Vronsky.
"There's one thing, that old love affair of Varenka's," she said, a natural chain of ideas bringing her to this point. "I would have liked to say something to Sergei Ivanovitch to prepare him. They're all men, I mean," she added, "awfully jealous over our past."
"Not all," said Dolly. "You judge by your own husband. It makes him miserable even now to remember Vronsky, eh? Well, that's true, isn't it?"
"Yes," Kitty answered, a pensive smile in her eyes.
"But I really don't know," the mother put in defense of her motherly care of her daughter, "what there was in your past that could worry him. That Vronsky paid you attention, well, that happens to every girl."
"Oh, yes. But we didn't mean that," Kitty said, flushing a little.
"No, let me speak," her mother went on. "Why, you yourself wouldn't let me have a talk with Vronsky, don't you remember?"
"Oh, Mama," said Kitty with an expression of suffering.
"There's no keeping you young people in check nowadays. Your friendship could not have gone beyond what was suitable. I should myself have called upon him to explain himself. But, my darling, it's not right for you to be excited. Please remember that and calm yourself."
"I'm perfectly calm, Maman."
"How fortunate it was for Kitty that Anna came then," said Dolly,
and how unfortunate for her. "Turned out quite the opposite," she said, struck by her own ideas. "Then Anna was so happy, and Kitty thought herself unhappy. Now it's just the opposite. I often think of her."
"A nice person to think about. Horrid, repulsive woman. No heart," said her mother,
who couldn't forget that Kitty had married not Vronsky, but Levin.
"What do you want to talk of it for?" Kitty said with annoyance. "I never think about it, and I don't want to think of it. No, I don't want to think of it," she said,
catching the sound of her husband's familiar step on the terrace.
"What's that you don't want to think about?"
inquired Levin, coming onto the terrace. But no one answered him, and he didn't repeat the question.
"I'm sorry I've broken in on your feminine parliament," he said, looking round at everyone discontentedly, perceiving that they had been talking of something they wouldn't talk about before him.
For a second, he felt that he was sharing the feeling of Agafia Mikhailovna, vexation at their making jam without water, and altogether at the alien Shishchabatsky element. He smiled, however, and went up to Kitty.
"Well, how are you?" he asked her,
looking at her with the expression with which everyone looked at her now.
"Oh, very well," said Kitty, smiling. "And how have things gone with you?"
"The wagons hold three times as much as the old carts did." "Well, are we going for the children? I've ordered the horses to be put in."
"What? You want to take Kitty in the trap?"
her mother said reproachfully.
"Yes, at a walking pace, princess."
Levin never called the princess Maman, as men often do call their mothers-in-law, and the princess disliked his not doing so. But though he liked and respected the princess, Levin couldn't call her so without a sense of profaning his feeling for his dead mother.
"Come with us, Maman," said Kitty.
"I don't like to see such imprudence."
"Well, I'll walk, then. It's good for me."
Kitty got up and went to her husband and took his hand.
"It may be good for you, but everything in moderation," said the princess.
"Well, Agafia Mikhailovna, is the jam done?"
said Levin, smiling to Agafia Mikhailovna and trying to cheer her up.
"Is it all right in the new way?"
"I suppose it's all right. To our way of thinking, it's boiled too long."
"It'll be all the better, Agafia Mikhailovna.
It won't mildew, even though our ice has begun to thaw already, so that we've no cool cellar to store it," said Kitty, at once divining her husband's motive and addressing the old housekeeper with the same feeling.
"But your pickle's so good. Mama says she never tasted any like it," she added, smiling, and putting her kerchief straight.
Agafia Mikhailovna looked angrily at Kitty. "You needn't try to console me, mistress. I need only to look at you with him, and I feel happy," she said.
And something in the rough familiarity of that "him" touched Kitty.
"Come along with us to look for mushrooms. You'll show us the best places."
Agafia Mikhailovna smiled and shook her head as though to say,
"I would like to be angry with you too, but I can't."
"Please follow my advice," said the princess. "Put some paper over the jam and moisten it with a little rum, and even without ice it will never go mildewy."
Chapter 3 Kitty was particularly glad of a chance being alone with her husband, for she had noticed the shade of mortification that had passed over his face, always so quick to reflect every feeling, at the moment when he had come onto the terrace and asked what they were talking of, and got no answer. When they had set off on foot ahead of the others, and had come out of sight of the house onto the hard, dusty road, strewn with rye ears and grain, she leaned more heavily on his arm and pressed it closer to her. He had quite forgotten the momentary unpleasant impression, and alone with her, he felt, now that the thought of her approaching motherhood was never for a moment absent from his mind, a new and delicious bliss, quite pure from sensuality, in being near the woman he loved. There was no need for speech, yet he longed to hear the sound of her voice, which, like her eyes, had changed since she had been with child. In her voice, as in her eyes,
There was that softness and gravity which is found in people continually concentrated on some cherished pursuit.
"So you're not tired?
Lean more on me," said he.
"No. I'm so glad of a chance of being alone with you. And I must confess, though I'm happy with them, I do miss our winter evenings alone."
"That was good, but this is even better. Both are better," he said, squeezing her hand.
"Do you know what we were talking about when you came in?"
"About jam?"
"Oh, yes. About jam, too. But afterward, about how men propose."
"Ah," said Levin, listening more to the sound of her voice than to the words she was saying, and all the while paying attention to the road which passed now through the woods, and avoiding places where she might make a false step.
"And about Sergei Ivanovitch and Varenka? You've noticed?"
"I'm very eager for it," she went on.
"What do you think about it?"
And she peered into his face.
"I don't know what to think," Levin answered, smiling. "Sergei seems very strange to me in that way. I told you, you know."
"Yes, that he was in love with that girl who died."
"That was when I was a child. I know about it from hearsay and tradition.
I remember him then. He was wonderfully sweet.
But I've watched him since with women. He's friendly. Some of them he likes. But one feels that to him they're simply people, not women."
"Yes, but now with Varenka, I think there's something."
"Perhaps there is. But one has to know him. He's a peculiar, wonderful person. He lives a spiritual life only. He's too pure, too exalted a nature."
"Why? Would this lower him, then?"
"No, but he's so used to a spiritual life that he can't reconcile himself with actual fact. And Varenka is, after all, fact." Levin had grown used by now to uttering his thoughts boldly, without taking the trouble to dress them in precise language. He knew that his wife, in such moments of loving tenderness as now, would understand what he meant to say from a hint, and she did understand him.
"Yes, but there's not so much of that actual fact about her as about me. I can see that he would never have cared for me. She is altogether spiritual."
"Oh, no. He's so fond of you. And I'm always so glad when my people like you."
"Yes, he's very nice to me, but..."
"It's not as it was with poor Nikolai. You really cared for each other," Levin finished. "Why not speak of him?" he added.
"I sometimes blame myself for not.
It ends in one's forgetting."
"Oh, how terrible and charming he was."
"Yes, what were we talking about?" Levin said after a pause.
"You think he can't fall in love?" said Kitty, translating into her own language.
"It's not so much he can't fall in love," Levin said, smiling, "but he hasn't the weakness necessary. I've always envied him, and even now, when I'm so happy, I still envy him."
"You envy him for not being able to fall in love?"
"I envy him for being better than me," said Levin. "He doesn't live for himself. His whole life is subordinated to his duty. And that's why he can be calm and contented."
"And you?" Kitty asked with an ironical and loving smile.
She could never have explained the chain of thought that made her smile. But the last link in it was that her husband, in exalting his brother and abasing himself, was not quite sincere. Kitty knew that this insincerity came from his love for his brother, from his sense of shame at being too happy, and above all, from his unflagging craving to be better. She loved it in him, and so she smiled.
"And you, what are you dissatisfied with?" she asked with the same smile.
Her disbelief in his self-dissatisfaction delighted him, and unconsciously he tried to draw her into giving utterance to the grounds of her disbelief.
"I'm happy, but dissatisfied with myself," he said.
"Why? How can you be dissatisfied with yourself if you are happy?"
"Well, how shall I say? In my heart I really care for nothing whatever but that you shouldn't stumble.
See?
Oh, but really, you mustn't skip about like that," he cried, breaking off to scold her for too agile a movement in stepping over a branch that lay in the path. But when I think about myself and compare myself with others, especially with my brother, I feel I'm a poor creature.
But in what way? Kitty pursued with the same smile. Don't you too work for others? What about your cooperative settlement and your work on the estate and your book?
Oh, but I feel.
And particularly just now, it's your fault, he said, pressing her hand, that all that doesn't count. I do it half-heartedly. If I could care for all that as I care for you. Instead of that, I do it these days like a task that is set me.
Well, what would you say about Papa? Asked Kitty. Is he a poor creature, then, as he does nothing for the public good?
He?
No.
But then one must have the simplicity, the straightforwardness, the goodness of your father. And I haven't got that. I do nothing, and I fret about it. It's all your doing. Before there was you, and this, too, he added with a glance toward her belly, which she understood, I put all my energies into work. Now I can't, and I'm ashamed. I do it just as though it were a task set me. I'm pretending.
Well, but would you like to change this minute with Sergei Ivanovitch? Said Kitty. Would you like to do this work for the general good, and to love the task set you as he does, and nothing else?
Of course not, said Levin. But I'm so happy that I don't understand anything.
So you think he'll propose today? He added, after a brief silence. I think so, and I don't think so, but I'm so eager for it. Here, wait a minute.
She stooped down and picked a wild chamomile at the edge of the path.
Come, count. He will propose, he won't, she said, giving him the flower.
He will? He won't, said Levin, tearing off the narrow white petals.
No, no.
Kitty, snatching at his hand, stopped him. She'd been watching his fingers with interest.
You picked off two.
Then we won't count this little one, said Levin, tearing off a little half-grown petal. Here's the trap overtaking us.
Aren't you tired, Kitty?
Called the princess.
Not in the least.
If you are, you can get in, if the horses are quiet and go at a walking pace.
But it wasn't worthwhile to get in. They were quite near the place, and all walked on together.
Chapter 4
Varenka, with her white kerchief over her black hair, surrounded by the children, gaily and good-humouredly looking after them, and at the same time visibly excited at the possibility of receiving a proposal from the man she cared for, looked very attractive. Sergei Ivanovitch walked beside her and never stopped admiring her. Looking at her, he recalled all the delightful things he had heard from her lips, all the good he knew about her, and became more and more conscious that the feeling he had for her was something special that he had felt long, long ago, and only once in his early youth. The feeling of happiness in being near her continually grew, and at last reached such a point that as he put a huge birch mushroom with a slender stalk and an upcurling rim in her basket, he looked straight into her face, and noticing the flush of joyful and alarmed excitement that overspread her face, he was confused himself, and smiled to her in silence, a smile that said too much.
If so, he said to himself, I ought to think it over and make up my mind and not give way like a boy to the impulse of a moment.
I'm going by myself to pick apart from all the rest, or else my efforts won't be noticed, he said. And he left the edge of the wood, where they were walking on low, silky grass between old birch trees standing far apart, and went more into the heart of the wood, where between the white birch trunks there were grey trunks of aspen and dark bushes of hazel. Walking some 40 paces away, Sergei Ivanovitch, knowing he was out of sight, stood still behind a bushy spindle tree in full flower with its pinkish-red catkins. It was perfectly still all around him. Only overhead in the birches under which he stood, the flies, like a swarm of bees, buzzed unceasingly, and from time to time the children's voices floated across to him. All at once he heard, not far from the edge of the wood, the sound of Varenka's contralto voice calling Grisha,
and a smile of delight passed over Sergei Ivanovitch's face. Conscious of this smile, he shook his head disapprovingly at his own condition, and taking out a cigar, he began lighting it. For a long while he couldn't strike a match against the trunk of a birch. The soft scales of the white bark rubbed off the phosphorus, and the light went out. At last, one of the matches burned, and the fragrant cigar smoke, hovering uncertainly like a broad sheet, stretched forward and upward over a bush under the drooping branches of the birch. Watching the streak of smoke, Sergei Ivanovitch walked slowly on, deliberating on his position.
"Why not?" he thought. "If it were only a passing fancy or a passion, if it were only this attraction, this mutual attraction, I can call it a mutual attraction, but I felt that it was in a contradiction with the whole bent of my life. If I felt that in giving way to this attraction I should be false to my vocation and my duty. But it's not so. The only thing I can say against it is that, when I lost Marie, I said to myself that I would remain faithful to her memory. That's the only thing I can say against my feeling." "That's important," Sergei Ivanovitch said to himself, feeling at the same time that this consideration had not the slightest importance for him personally, but would only perhaps detract from his romantic role in the eyes of others. "But apart from that, however much I searched, I would never find anything to say against my feeling. If I were choosing by considerations of suitability alone, I couldn't have found anything better." However many women and girls he thought of, whom he knew, he couldn't think of a girl who united to such a degree all, positively all, the qualities he would wish to see in his wife. She had all the charm and freshness of youth, but she was not a child. And if she loved him, she loved him consciously as a woman ought to love. That was one thing. Another point, she was not only far from being worldly, but had an unmistakable distaste for worldly society, and at the same time she knew the world, and had all the ways of a woman of the best society, which were absolutely essential to Sergei Ivanovitch's conception of the woman who was to share his life. Third, she was religious. And not like a child, unconsciously religious and good, as Kitty, for example, was, but her life was founded on religious principles. Even in trifling matters, Sergei Ivanovitch found in her all that he wanted in his wife. She was poor and alone in the world, so she wouldn't bring with her a mass of relations and their influence into her husband's house, as he saw now in Kitty's case. She would owe everything to her husband, which was what he had always desired, too, for his future family life. And this girl, who united all these qualities, loved him. He was a modest man, but he couldn't help seeing it. And he loved her. There was one consideration against it, his age. But he was of a long-lived family. He hadn't a single grey hair. No one would have taken him for 40. And he remembered Varenka's saying that it was only in Russia that men of 50 thought themselves old, and that in France a man of 50 considers himself dans la force de l'âge, while a man of 40 is un jeune homme. But what did the mere reckoning of years matter when he felt as young in heart as he had been 20 years ago? Was it not youth to feel as he felt now, when coming from the other side to the edge of the wood, he saw in the glowing light of the slanting sunbeams the graceful figure of Varenka in her yellow dress with her basket, walking lightly by the trunk of an old birch tree, and when this impression of the sight of Varenka blended so harmoniously with the beauty of the view, of the yellow oat field lying bathed in the slanting sunshine, and beyond it the distant ancient forest flecked with yellow and melting into the blue of the distance. His heart throbbed joyously. A tender feeling came over him. He felt that he had made up his mind. Varenka, who had just crouched down to pick a mushroom, rose with a supple movement and looked around. Flinging away the cigar, Sergei Ivanovitch advanced with resolute steps toward her. Chapter 5.
Varvara Andreevna, when I was very young, I set before myself the ideal of the woman I loved and would be happy to call my wife. I have lived through a long life, And now, for the first time, I've met what I sought in you. I love you, and offer you my hand.
Sergei Ivanovitch was saying this to himself while he was 10 paces from Varenka. Kneeling down, with her hands over the mushrooms to guard them from Grisha, she was calling little Masha.
"Come here, little ones. There are so many," she was saying in her sweet, deep voice.
Seeing Sergei Ivanovitch approaching, she didn't get up and didn't change her position. But everything told him that she felt his presence and was glad of it.
"Well, did you find some?" she asked from under the white kerchief, turning her beautiful, gently smiling face to him.
"Not one," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "Did you?"
She didn't answer, busy with the children who thronged about her.
"That one, too, near the twig."
She pointed out to little Masha a mushroom split in half across its rosy cap by the dry grass from under which it thrust itself. Varenka got up while Masha picked the mushroom, breaking it into 2 white halves.
"This brings back my childhood," she added, moving apart from the children by Sergei Ivanovitch.
They walked on for some steps in silence. Varenka saw that he wanted to speak. She guessed of what, and felt faint with joy and panic. They had walked so far away that no one could hear them now, but still he didn't begin to speak. It would have been better for Varenka to be silent. After a silence, it would have been easier for them to say what they wanted to say than after talking about mushrooms. But against her own will, as it were accidentally, Varenka said,
"So you found nothing. In the middle of the wood there are always fewer, though."
Sergei Ivanovitch sighed and made no answer. He was annoyed that she had spoken about the mushrooms. He wanted to bring her back to the first words she had uttered about her childhood. But after a pause of some length, as though against his own will, he made an observation in response to her last words.
"I have heard that the white edible mushrooms are found principally at the edge of the wood, though I can't tell them apart."
Some minutes more passed. They moved still further away from the children and were quite alone. Varenka's heart throbbed so that she heard it beating and felt that she was turning red and pale and red again. To be the wife of a man like Koznishev, after her position with Madame Stahl, was to her imagination the height of happiness. Besides, she was almost certain that she was in love with him. And this moment it would have to be decided. She felt frightened. She dreaded both his speaking and his not speaking.
Now or never, it must be said. That Sergei Ivanovitch felt too. Everything in the expression, the flushed cheeks and the downcast eyes of Varenka betrayed a painful suspense. Sergei Ivanovitch saw it and felt sorry for her. He felt even that to say nothing now would be a slight to her. Rapidly, in his own mind, he ran over all the arguments in support of his decision. He even said over to himself the words in which he meant to propose. But instead of those words, some utterly unexpected reflection that occurred to him made him ask, "What's the difference between the birch mushroom and the white mushroom?"
Varenka's lips quivered with emotion as she answered, "In the top part there's scarcely any difference. It's in the stalk." And as soon as these words were uttered, both he and she felt that it was over, that what was to have been said would not be said, and their emotion, which had up to then been continually growing more intense, began to subside.
"The birch mushroom stalk suggests a dark man's chin after 2 days without shaving," said Sergei Ivanovitch, speaking quite calmly now.
"Yes, that's true," answered Varenka, smiling. And unconsciously the direction of their walk changed. They began to turn toward the children. Varenka felt both hurt and ashamed. At the same time, she had a sense of relief. When he'd got home again and went over the whole subject, Sergei Ivanovitch thought his previous decision had been a mistaken one. He could not be false to the memory of Marie.
"Gently, children, gently!"
Levin shouted quite angrily to the children, standing before his wife to protect her when a crowd of children flew with shrieks of delight to meet them. Behind the children, Sergei Ivanovitch and Varenka walked out of the wood. Kitty had no need to ask Varenka. She saw from the calm and somewhat crestfallen faces of both that her plans hadn't come off.
"Well?" her husband questioned her as they were going home again.
"It didn't bite," said Kitty, her smile and manner of speaking recalling her father, a likeness Levin often noticed with pleasure.
"How didn't bite?"
"I'll show you," she said, taking her husband's hand, lifting it to her mouth, and just faintly brushing it with closed lips, like a kiss on a bishop's hand.
"Which didn't bite?"
he said, laughing.
"Both. But it should have been like this."
"There are some peasants coming."
"Oh, they didn't see."
Chapter 6 During the time of the children's tea, the grown-ups sat in the balcony and talked as though nothing had happened, though they all, especially Sergei Ivanovitch and Varenka, were very well aware that there had happened an event which, though negative, was of very great importance. They both had the same feeling, rather like that of a schoolboy after an examination which has left him in the same class, or shut him out of the school forever. Everyone present, feeling too that something had happened, talked eagerly about extraneous subjects. Levin and Kitty were particularly happy and conscious of their love that evening. And their happiness in their love seemed to imply a disagreeable slur on those who would have liked to feel the same and couldn't. And they felt a prick of conscience.
"Mark my words, Alexander will not come," said the old princess.
That evening they were expecting Stepan Arkadyevich Oblonsky to come down by train, and the old prince had written that possibly he might come too.
"And I know why," the princess went on. "He says that young people ought to be left alone for a while at first."
"But Papa has left us alone. We've never seen him," said Kitty.
"Besides, we're not young people. We're old married people by now." "Only if he doesn't come, I shall say goodbye to you children," said the princess, sighing mournfully.
"What nonsense, Mamma," both the daughters said, falling upon her at once.
"And how do you suppose he is feeling? Why, now—"
And suddenly there was an unexpected quiver in the princess's voice. Her daughters were silent and looked at one another.
"Maman always finds something to be miserable about," they said in that glance.
They didn't know that, happy as the princess was in her daughter's house, and useful as she felt herself to be there, she had been extremely miserable, both on her own account and her husband's, ever since they had married their last and favourite daughter, and the old home had been left empty.
"What is it, Agafea Mikhailovna?"
Kitty asked suddenly of Agafea Mikhailovna, who was standing with a mysterious air and a face full of meaning.
"About supper."
"Well, that's right," said Dolly. "You'll go and arrange it, and I'll go and hear Grisha repeat his lesson, or else he'll have done nothing all day."
"That's my lesson. No, Dolly, I'm going," said Levin, jumping up.
Grisha, who was by now in high school, had to go over the lessons of the term in the summer holidays. Darya Alexandrovna, who'd been studying Latin with her son in Moscow before, had made it a rule on coming to the Levins to go over with him at least once a day the most difficult lessons of Latin and arithmetic. Levin had offered to take her place, but the mother, having once overheard Levin's lesson, and noticing that it was not given exactly as the teacher in Moscow had given it, said resolutely, though with much embarrassment and anxiety not to mortify Levin, that they must keep strictly to the book as the teacher had done, and that she had better undertake it again herself. Levin was amazed both at Stepan Arkadyevich, who, by neglecting his duty, threw upon the mother the supervision of studies of which she had no comprehension, and at the teachers for teaching the children so badly. But he promised his sister-in-law to give the lessons exactly as she wished, and he went on teaching Grisha, not in his own way, but by the book, and so took little interest in it, and often forgot the hour of the lesson. So it had been today.
"No, I'm going, Dolly. You sit still," he said. "We'll do it all properly, like the book.
Only when Stiva comes and we go out shooting, then we shall have to miss it."
and Levin went to Grisha. Varenka was saying the same thing to Kitty. Even in the happy, well-ordered household of the Levins, Varenka had succeeded in making herself useful.
"I'll see to the supper. You sit still," she said, and got up to go to Agafea Mikhailovna. "Yes, yes, most likely they've not been able to get chickens. If so, ours..."
"Agafea Mikhailovna and I will see about it."
And Varenka vanished with her.
"What a nice girl," said the princess.
"Not nice, maman.
She's an exquisite girl. There's no one else like her."
"So you're expecting Stepan Arkadyevitch today," said Sergei Ivanovitch, evidently not disposed to pursue the conversation about Varenka. "It would be difficult to find two brothers-in-law more unlike than yours," he said with a subtle smile. "One always on the move, living only in society like a fish in water. The other, Alkostya, lively, alert, quick in everything. But as soon as he's in society, he either sinks into apathy or struggles helplessly like a fish on land."
"Yes, he's very thoughtless," said the princess, addressing Sergei Ivanovitch. "I've been meaning, indeed, to ask you to tell him that it's out of the question for her," she indicated Kitty, "to stay here, that she positively must come to Moscow. He talks of getting a doctor down..."
"Maman, he'll do everything. He has agreed to everything," Kitty said, angry with her mother for appealing to Sergei Ivanovitch to judge in such a matter. In the middle of their conversation, they heard the snorting of horses and the sound of wheels on the gravel. Dolly had not time to get up to go and meet her husband, when from the window of the room below where Grisha was having his lesson, Levin leapt out and helped Grisha out after him.
"It's Stiva," Levin shouted from under the balcony. "We've finished, Dolly. Don't be afraid," he added, and started running like a boy to meet the carriage.
"Is, ia, id, ejus, ejus, ejus," shouted Grisha, skipping along the avenue.
"And someone else, too.
Papa, of course," cried Levin, stopping at the entrance of the avenue.
"Kitty, don't come down the steep staircase. Go around."
But Levin had been mistaken in taking the person sitting in the carriage for the old prince. As he got nearer to the carriage, he saw beside Stepan Arkadyevitch not the prince, but a handsome, stout young man in a Scotch cap with long ribbons behind. This was Vasenka Veslovsky, a distant cousin of the Shestchabatskys, a brilliant young gentleman in Petersburg and Moscow society.
"A wonderful fellow and a keen sportsman," Stepan Arkadyevitch said, introducing him.
Not a whit abashed by the disappointment caused by his having come in place of the old prince, Veslovsky greeted Levin gaily, claiming acquaintance with him in the past, and snatching up Grisha into the carriage, he lifted him over the pointer that Stepan Arkadyevitch had brought with him. Levin didn't get into the carriage, but walked behind. He was rather vexed at the non-arrival of the old prince, whom he liked more and more the more he saw of him, and also at the arrival of this Vasenka Veslovsky, a quite uncongenial and superfluous person. He seemed to him still more uncongenial and superfluous when, on approaching the steps where the whole party, children and grown-ups, were gathered together in much excitement, Levin saw Vasenka Veslovsky, with a particularly warm and gallant air, kissing Kitty's hand.
"Your wife and I are cousins and very old friends," said Vasenka Veslovsky, once more shaking Levin's hand with great warmth.
"Well, are there plenty of birds?" Stepan Arkadyevitch asked Levin, hardly leaving time for everyone to utter their greetings. "We've come with the most savage intentions."
"Why, maman, they've not been in Moscow since. Look, Tanya, here's something for you. Get it, please. It's in the carriage behind," he said, talking in all directions.
"How pretty you've grown, Dolly,"
he said to his wife, once more kissing her hand, holding it in one of his and patting it with the other. Levin, who a minute before had been in the happiest frame of mind, now looked darkly at everyone, and everything displeased him.
"Who was it he kissed yesterday with those lips?" he thought,
looking at Stepan Arkadyevitch's tender demonstrations to his wife. He looked at Dolly, and he didn't like her, either.
"She doesn't believe in his love, so what is she so pleased about?"
Revolting, thought Levin. He looked at the princess, who had been so dear to him a minute before, and he didn't like the manner in which she welcomed this Vasenka with his ribbons, just as though she were in her own house. Even Sergei Ivanovitch, who'd also come out onto the steps, seemed to him unpleasant with the show of cordiality with which he met Stepan Arkadyevitch, though Levin knew that his brother neither liked nor respected Oblonsky. And Varenka, even she seemed hateful with her sainte-nitouche air, making the acquaintance of this gentleman, yet all the while she was thinking of nothing but getting married. And more hateful than anyone was Kitty for falling in with the tone of gaiety with which this gentleman regarded his visit in the country, as though it was a holiday for himself and everyone else. And unpleasant above all was that particular smile with which she responded to his smile. Talking noisily, they all went into the house, but as soon as they were all seated, Levin turned and went out. Kitty saw that something was bothering her husband. She tried to seize a moment to speak to him alone, but he made haste to get away from her, saying he was needed at the office. It was long since that his own work on the estate had seemed to him so important as at that moment.
"It's all holiday for them," he thought, "but these are no holiday matters. They won't wait, and there's no living without them."
Chapter 7 Levin came back to the house only when they sent to summon him to supper. Kitty and Agafea Mikhailovna were standing on the stairs, consulting about wines for supper.
"But why are you making all this fuss? Have what we usually do."
"No, Stiva doesn't drink..." "Kostya, stop. What's the matter?"
Kitty began, hurrying after him, but he strode ruthlessly away to the dining room without waiting for her, and at once joined in the lively general conversation which was being maintained there by Vasenka Veslovsky and Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Well, what do you say? Are we going shooting tomorrow?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Please, let's go," said Veslovsky, moving to another chair, where he sat down sideways with one fat leg tucked under him.
"I shall be delighted. We'll go.
And have you had any shooting yet this year?" said Levin to Veslovsky, looking intently at his leg, but speaking with that forced amiability that Kitty knew so well in him, and that was so out of keeping with him.
"I can't answer for our finding grouse, but there are plenty of snipe. Only we ought to start early. You're not tired. Are you tired, Stiva?"
"Me? Tired? I've never been tired. Suppose we stay up all night. Let's go for a walk." "Yes, really. Let's not go to bed at all. Excellent," Veslovsky chimed in.
"Oh, we all know you can do without sleep and keep other people up, too," Dolly said to her husband, with that faint note of irony in her voice, which she almost always had now with him.
"But to my thinking, it's time for bed now. I'm going. I don't want supper."
"No, do stay a while, Dolly dear," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, going round to her behind the table where they were having supper. "I've so much still to tell you."
"Nothing much, I suppose. Do you know Veslovsky's been at Anna's, and he's going to them again? You know, they're hardly 50 miles from us, and I, too, must certainly go over there. Veslovsky, come here."
Vasenka crossed over to the ladies and sat down beside Kitty.
"Ah, do tell me, please. You've stayed with her. How was she?"
Darya Alexandrovna appealed to him. Levin was left at the other end of the table, and though he never paused in his conversation with the princess and Varenka, he saw that there was an eager and mysterious conversation going on between Stepan Arkadyevitch, Dolly, Kitty, and Veslovsky. And that was not all. He saw on his wife's face an expression of deep feeling as she gazed with fixed eyes on the handsome face of Vasenka, who was telling them something with great animation.
"It's exceedingly nice at their place," Veslovsky was telling them about Vronsky and Anna. "I can't, of course, take it upon myself to judge, but in their house you feel the real feeling of home."
"What do they intend doing?"
"I believe they think of going to Moscow." "How jolly it would be for us all to go over to them together. When are you going there?"
Stepan Arkadyevitch asked Vasenka.
"I'm spending July there."
"Will you go?"
Stepan Arkadyevitch asked his wife.
I've been wanting to a long while.
I shall certainly go, said Dolly.
I'm sorry for her, and I know her. She's a splendid woman. I'll go alone when you go back, and then I shall be in no one's way. And it will be better without you.
To be sure, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. And you, Kitty?
I? Why should I go? Kitty said, flushing all over, and she glanced around at her husband.
Do you know Anna Arkadyevna, then? Veslovsky asked her. She's a very fascinating woman.
Yes, she answered Veslovsky, crimsoning still more.
She got up and walked across to her husband.
Are you going shooting, then, tomorrow? She asked.
His jealousy had, in these few moments, especially at the flush that had overspread her cheeks while she was talking to Veslovsky, gone far indeed. Now, as he heard her words, he construed them in his own fashion. Strange as it was to him afterward to recall it, it seemed to him at the moment clear that in asking whether he was going shooting, all she cared to know was whether he would give that pleasure to Vasenka Veslovsky, with whom, he imagined, she was in love.
"Yes, I'm going," he answered her in an unnatural voice, disagreeable to himself.
"No, better spend the day here tomorrow, or Dolly won't see anything of her husband, and set off the day after," said Kitty.
The motive of Kitty's words was interpreted by Levin thus.
"Don't separate me from him. I don't care about your going, but do let me enjoy the company of this delightful young man."
"Oh, if you wish, we'll stay here tomorrow," Levin answered, with peculiar amiability.
Vasenka, meanwhile, utterly unsuspecting the misery his presence had occasioned, got up from the table after Kitty, and watching her with smiling and admiring eyes, he followed her. Levin saw that look. He turned white, and for a minute he could hardly breathe.
"How dare he look at my wife like that?" was the feeling that boiled within him.
"Tomorrow, then. Do please, let's go," said Vasenka, sitting down on a chair, and again tucking his leg under him, as was his habit.
Levin's jealousy went further still.
Already he saw himself a deceived husband, looked upon by his wife and her lover as simply necessary to provide them with the conveniences and pleasures of life.
But in spite of that, he made polite and hospitable inquiries of Vasenka about his shooting, his gun, and his boots, and agreed to go shooting the next day. Happily for Levin, the old princess cut short his agonies by getting up herself and advising Kitty to go to bed. But even at this point, Levin couldn't escape another agony. As Vasenka said good night to his hostess, he leaned down to kiss her hand again, but Kitty, reddening, drew back her hand and said with a naive bluntness, for which the old princess scolded her afterward,
"That's not customary in our house."
In Levin's eyes, she was to blame for having allowed such relations to arise, and still more to blame for showing so awkwardly that she didn't like them.
"Why, how can one want to go to bed?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, who, after drinking several glasses of wine at supper, was now in his most charming and poetical mood. "Look, Kitty," he said, pointing to the moon which had just risen behind the lime trees. "How exquisite! Veslovsky! This is the time for a serenade. You know, he has a splendid voice. We practiced songs together along the road. He's brought some lovely songs with him, two new ones."
When the party had broken up, Stepan Arkadyevitch walked a long while about the avenue with Veslovsky. Their voices could be heard singing one of the new songs. Levin, hearing these voices, sat scowling in an armchair in his wife's bedroom, and maintained an obstinate silence when she asked him what was wrong. But when at last, with a timid glance, she hazarded the question, "Was there perhaps something you disliked about Veslovsky?" it burst out, and he told her all. He was humiliated himself at what he was saying, and that exasperated him all the more. He stood facing her, with his eyes glittering menacingly under his scowling brows, and he pressed his strong arms across his chest as though he were straining every nerve to hold himself in. The expression on his face would have been grim and even cruel if it had not at the same time had a look of suffering which touched her. His jaws were twitching and his voice kept breaking.
You must understand that I'm not jealous. That's a nasty word. I can't be jealous and believe that... Well, I can't say what I feel. But this is awful. I'm not jealous, but I'm offended. Humiliated that anybody dare think, that anybody dare look at you with eyes like that.
Eyes like what? Said Kitty,
trying as conscientiously as possible to recall every word and gesture of that evening, and every shade implied in them. In the very depths of her heart, she did think there had been something precisely at the moment when Vasenka had followed her to the other end of the table, but she dared not admit it even to herself, and would have been even more unable to bring herself to say so to him, and so increase his suffering.
And what can there possibly be attractive about me as I am now?
Oh, he cried, clutching at his head, you shouldn't say that. If you'd been attractive then...
Oh, no, Kostya. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, do listen, she said, looking at him with an expression of compassionate pain. Why, what can you be thinking about, when for me there's no one in the world, no one, no one.
Would you like me never to see anyone? For the first minute she'd been offended at his jealousy. She was angry that the slightest amusement, even the most innocent, should be forbidden her. But now she would readily have sacrificed not merely such trifles, but everything for his peace of mind, to save him from the agony he was suffering. "You must understand the horror and absurdity of my position," he went on in a desperate whisper. "That he's in my house, that he's done nothing improper, after all, except his free and easy manner, and the way he sits on his legs. He thinks it's the best possible form, and so I'm obliged to be civil to him."
"But, Kostya, you're exaggerating," said Kitty, at the bottom of her heart rejoicing at the depth of his love for her, shown now in his jealousy. "The most awful part of it is that you're just as you always are, and especially now, when to me you're something sacred, and we're so happy, so particularly happy. And all of a sudden this trash... Oh, he's not trash. Why should I abuse him? I've nothing to do with him. But why should my and your happiness...
Do you know, I understand now what it's all come from," Kitty was beginning.
"Well, what?
What?" "I saw how you looked while we were talking at supper."
"Well, well," Levin said in dismay.
She told him what they had been talking about, and as she told him, she was breathless with emotion. Levin was silent for a time, and then he scanned her pale and distressed face, and suddenly he clutched at his head.
"Katya, I've been worrying you.
Darling, forgive me. It's madness. Katya, I'm a criminal. And how could you be so distressed at such idiocy?"
"Oh, I was sorry for you."
"For me?
For me? How mad I am. But why make you miserable? It's awful to think that any outsider can shatter our happiness."
"It's humiliating, too, of course."
"Oh, then I'll keep him here all summer, and will overwhelm him with civility," said Levin, kissing her hands. "You shall see. Tomorrow?" "Oh, yes. We're going shooting tomorrow."
Chapter 8 The next day, before the ladies were up, a shooting break and a cart were at the door waiting for them, and Laska, aware since early morning that they were going shooting, after much whining and darting to and fro, had sat herself down in the cart beside the coachman, and, disapproving of the delay, was excitedly watching the door from which the sportsman still didn't come out. The first to come out was Vasenka Veslovsky, in new high boots that reached halfway up his thick thighs, in a green shirt with a new leather cartridge belt, and in his Scotch cap with streamers, with a brand-new English hammerless gun without a sling. Laska flew up to welcome him, and jumping up, asked him, in her own way, whether the others were coming soon. But getting no answer, she returned to her observation post and sank into repose again, her head on one side and one ear pricked up to listen. At last the door opened with a creak, and Stepan Arkadyevitch's spotted tan pointer, Crack, flew out, running round and round and turning over in the air. Stepan Arkadyevitch himself followed with a gun in his hand and a cigar in his mouth.
"Good dog, Crack!"
he cried encouragingly to the dog, who put up his paws on his chest, catching at his game bag. Stepan Arkadyevitch was dressed in rough leggings and linen bands wrapped round his feet, torn trousers, and a short coat. On his head there was a wreck of a hat of indefinite form, but his gun, of a new patent, was a perfect gem, and his game bag and cartridge belt, though worn, were of the very best quality.
Vasenka Veslovsky had had no notion before that it was truly chic to be in tatters, but to have a shooting outfit of the best quality. He saw it now as he looked at Stepan Arkadyevitch, radiant in his rags, graceful, well-fed, and joyous, a typical gentleman. And he made up his mind that next time he went shooting, he would certainly adopt the same get-up.
"Well, and what about our host?" he asked.
"A young wife," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling.
"Yes, and such a charming one."
"He came down dressed. No doubt he's run up to her again."
Stepan Arkadyevitch guessed right. Levin had run up again to his wife to ask her once more if she forgave him for his idiocy yesterday, and, moreover, to beg her for heaven's sake to be more careful. The important thing was for her to keep away from the children. They might any minute push against her. Then he had once more to hear her declare that she wasn't angry with him for going away for 2 days, and to beg her to be sure to send him a note the next morning by a servant on horseback, to write him, if only 2 words, to let him know that all was well with her. Kitty was distressed, as she always was, at parting for a couple of days from her husband, but when she saw his animated figure, looking big and strong in his shooting boots and his white shirt, and his radiant excitement, incomprehensible to her, she forgot her own chagrin for the sake of his pleasure, and said good-bye to him cheerfully.
"Sorry, gentlemen," he said, running out onto the steps. "Have you put the lunch in? Why is the chestnut on the right? Well, it doesn't matter. Laska, down! Go and lie down!" "Put it in with the heifers," he said to the herdsman, who was waiting for him at the steps with some question. "Excuse me, here comes another villain."
Levin jumped out of the shooting brake, in which he had already taken his seat, to meet the carpenter, who came toward the steps with a ruler in his hand.
"You didn't come to the office yesterday, and now you're detaining me. Well, what is it?"
"Would your honour let me make another turning? It's only 3 steps to add, and we make it just fit at the same time. It would be much more convenient."
"You should have listened to me," Levin answered with annoyance. "I said fix the string boards first and then fit the treads. Now there's no way of changing it. Do as I tell you and make a new staircase."
The point was that in the lodge that was being built, the carpenter had spoiled the staircase, fitting it together without calculating the elevation, so that the steps all sloped when put into place. Now the carpenter wanted to keep the same staircase, to add 3 steps.
"It'll be much better."
"But where's your staircase going to reach with its 3 steps?
"Why, my heavens, sir," the carpenter said with a contemptuous smile. "It comes out right at the very spot. It starts from the bottom," he said with a persuasive gesture. "It will go up and up till it gets there."
"But the 3 steps will add to the length, too."
"Where is it to come out?" "Why, to be sure, it'll start from the bottom, and it's certain to get there," the carpenter said obstinately and convincingly.
"It'll reach the ceiling and go up the wall." "Heavens, no, sir. Why, it'll go up and up till it gets there."
Levin took out a ramrod and began sketching the plan of the staircase in the dust.
"There, do you see?"
"As your honour likes," said the carpenter, with a sudden gleam in his eyes, obviously understanding the thing at last. "It seems it'll be best to make a new one."
"Well, then, do it as you're told,"
Levin shouted, seating himself in the shooting brake. "We're off. Hold the dogs, Philip."
Levin felt now, on leaving behind his family and all the household cares, such an eager sense of joy in life and expectation that he wasn't disposed to talk. Besides that, he had that feeling of concentrated excitement that every sportsman experiences as he approaches the scene of action. If he had anything on his mind at that moment, it was only the doubt of whether they would find anything in the Kolpensky marsh, whether Laska would show to advantage in competition with Krak, and whether he would shoot well that day himself. Not to disgrace himself before a new spectator, not to be outdone by Oblonsky. That, too, was a thought that crossed his mind. Oblonsky was feeling the same, and he, too, was not talkative. Vasenka Veslovsky alone kept up a ceaseless flow of cheerful chatter. As he listened to him now, Levin felt ashamed to think how unfair he had been to him the day before. Vasenka was really a nice fellow, simple, good-hearted, and very good-humoured. If Levin had met him before he was married, he would have made friends with him. Levin rather disliked his way of treating life as a never-ending holiday, and the sort of free and easy air of elegance about him. It was as though he assumed a high degree of importance in himself that couldn't be disputed, because he had long nails and a Scotch cap, and everything else to correspond. But this could be forgiven for the sake of his good nature and good breeding. Levin liked him for his good education, for speaking excellent French and English, and for being a man of the world. Vasenka was extremely delighted with a left horse, a horse of the Don steppes. He kept praising him enthusiastically. "How fine it must be galloping over the steppes on a Cossack horse, eh? Isn't it?" he said. He had imagined riding on a Cossack horse as something wild and romantic, and it turned out to be nothing of the sort. But his simplicity, particularly in conjunction with his good looks, his amiable smile, and the grace of his movements, was very attractive. Either because his nature was sympathetic to Levin, or because Levin was trying to atone for his sins of the previous evening by seeing nothing but what was good in him, Levin liked his company. After they had driven about 2 miles from home, Veslovsky missed his cigars and wallet, and didn't know whether he had lost them or left them on the table. In the pocketbook there were 370 rubles, and so the matter couldn't be left in uncertainty. "Do you know what, Levin? I'll gallop home on that left trace horse. That'll be splendid, eh?" he said, preparing to get out. "No, why should you?" answered Levin, calculating that Vasenka could hardly weigh less than 240 pounds. "I'll send the coachman." The coachman rode back on the trace horse, and Levin himself drove the remaining pair.